Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Weekday Wednesday, Tucson, Arizona's number one online radio podcast about all things medical cannabis. Your host, Belle Starr.
And the Cannabis Kid. Our show features news, interviews, and all the latest information about anything and everything medical cannabis related in Tucson, Arizona,
and the world at large. We'd love to hear from you. Please give us a call live at 646-915-8421. You can like us on Facebook, follow us on all social media, or email thctucson@gmail.com.
We would like to thank Tumbleweed Health Center and Studio C, along with our many sponsors, for hosting our show every week. With the lowest price certifications in town, you'll find hemp products, accessories, and all things related to medical cannabis education.
Visit Tumbleweed Health Center at 5315 East Broadway Boulevard or online at tumbleweedhealthcenter.com. And remember,
be smart,
be safe,
and educate.
All right. Woo-hoo. Welcome to Weekday Wednesday. We got walkers outside.
Good morning, everybody. How's it going?
Good morning. The walkers are walking briskly on this beautiful 62 degrees and mostly cloudy day. Right so far now. How do you like that? Right so far now. I reckon.
That's pretty cool. I never knew the pomegranate tree changed colors. You got like a little fall going on in your backyard.
I know, I did too. I was like, wow, look at that. Beautiful.
It is really beautiful.
It's gorgeous. Thank you, pomegranate tree.
I might remove the pool too.
Oh, pomegranate tree.
We should decorate it.
It's earned it.
It's definitely earned it. How are you folks doing
out there? Welcome to Weekday Wednesday. We're decorating pomegranate trees any given moment now. Welcome to Weekday Wednesday.
You're Belle Starr, and I'm the Cannabis Kid.
You're the Cannabis Kid, and we are live.
I was going to say, I'm Belle Starr, and you're the Cannabis Kid.
Okay. Is that where we're going now?
No, but I did a little bit of research about Belle Starr the other night.
Oh, no.
Just because it runs so close in my history.
Yeah.
In fact, I'm not blood related to her. Listen to this. She actually married our great-great-great-great-great uncle, Sam Starr.
Oh.
And her name was Belle Shirley Lilla something star. She had like five last names.
Myra something.
Something.
Yeah.
Hung out with Jesse James.
Yeah.
And we are really the Hatfield.
The Hatfield.
Yeah. Huh. We're in that feud. Sam Starr is related to that. And Sam Starr hangs out with that whole group. Yeah. Now we're part of the Hatfield part.
Okay.
Me and you.
All right. Oh, okay.
Part of the Hatfield part.
Not the McCoys. All right.
So, kind of fun. It just kind of randomly came up. I had a friend that was like, oh, you do a radio show? And I said, yeah. And I was like, she's like, can I, I'll send you some information on it. So I sent her a little email, and she's like, Belle Starr? Is Belle Starr related?
And that's how it all
And it all kind of came out, and we started talking about it. And we looked at Belle Starr, cattle rustler.
She's a badass.
She is.
Horse thief. She had her own gang.
It's really funny. Her son and daughter, it's her and Sam. She had a couple kids, I think, from another. She was married twice, I think. Three times. Because then she married our great-great uncle.
We know about.
Jim July Starr. Because she had to keep, so she could keep her Cherokee property.
Oh.
Because she married Sam Starr, who is Cherokee from the Starr Clan.
All right.
There was actually a tribe called the Starr Clan, which is kind of weird. It was just so much fun that we were doing that last night.
Wow.
Enjoyed all of it.
Excellent.
So I know a little bit more about you.
We're
coming to work today.
We're badass. So watch your back.
Yes.
Because that poor lady Belle Starr did get shot in the back.
She did. And her death is still a mystery.
Yeah, they don't know what sissy shot her.
In the back.
Come on, for real? That's lame.
They think it was someone from the dance that night that didn't get to dance with her.
Oh. Well.
How about that?
Troubled little soul there.
Dang right, it was a troubled little soul.
Boy, howdy. Well, speaking of troubled souls, that's not us, is it?
No. I don't got none of that going on.
All right. Well, we have a lot going on about cannabis. We have a great show today. We always have a great show, I think.
We sure do.
As you mix your tea there and our little moon and star strainer. We have a former corrections officer and now private eye on our show, Carrie Roberts of LEAP. She will be coming on shortly here. And we love having them on our show. What an awesome organization, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition.
And what a great group to have. I mean, we need someone who kind of is on that level of, you know, when cops are cops and sheriffs and the law enforcement, the camaraderie is strong. So when you have someone that can speak eye to eye with another law enforcement, just like another Marine or another Air Force, it's easier because they're coming from the same point of entry. And so I think it's really important to have this group along because they're able to relate and talk and say, hey, you know, this is how we've been looking at this and this is how things have been going. Have you guys been seeing it the same way? You know, how tired are you of fighting this war on drugs and knowing that, you know, at one point it was just a scare tactic for the American people.
Yeah.
And so I'm really anxious to talk to her about, you know, privatized prisons. Why
$50,000 a year it costs to house an inmate. I'm just flabbergasted by that. That's just, we don't even make that. That's crazy.
Mm-mm.
That's insane. I just don't even know what to say to that. Anyway, Carrie Roberts is coming on shortly here. We have a little news report from AZ Court. Medical marijuana patients cannot sell to other patients. Why not? It's our weed. All right. The Arizona Court of Appeals has ruled that Arizona's medical marijuana patients cannot sell marijuana to other patients. The Arizona Medical Marijuana Act, AMMA, states that medical marijuana patients can't be prosecuted for providing marijuana to other patients as long as nothing of value is transferred in return. The law also states that any medical marijuana cardholder who sells marijuana to a person who is not allowed to possess marijuana for medical purposes will have their cards revoked, which implies a patient can donate marijuana to another patient. And we know the definition of donate to you just give it to them. Don't ask for anything. It's a gift, people, when you donate to the Red Cross, you give your blood to them. You don't ask for it back. Well, they might give you an orange or something, but, you know, that's just so you don't pass out and fall on their floor. Anyway, this is why Judge Fields wrote in his 2014 ruling that clause necessarily implies that a qualifying patient can sell marijuana. But the Court of Appeals judge ruled otherwise. They stated that allowing such patient-to-patient transactions would create an incentive to embark on a sales enterprise. This is true. Until now, until another court reviews this issue, medical marijuana patients must adhere to the latest ruling to refrain from breaking the law. Well, there you have it, folks. Patients, if you want to donate, that's fine, but you've got to just give it to someone without, you know, you can't ask them to mow your lawn or, you know, do your dishes or spot you a 20 because you need gas to get back home. You know, that just don't fly. What a beautiful little mug you're drinking out of this morning.
It's my Tumbleweed Health Center Cannabis Kid mug that I got on our four-year anniversary.
All right.
It's pretty fantastic.
Yeah,
it's my
4 years
first time
of Tumbleweed. Oh, nice. Excellent. I bet that's going to keep liquids really hot.
Mm-hmm.
It's metal.
Well,
of sorts.
Just this is metal.
Well, what's
this?
This
is glass with the, you know, reflective, the reflective paint on it.
All right, then.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well,
right.
We've got reflective paint and glass.
I think All right. That needs to be filled again.
There you
that's
go.
That's just me.
There you go. All right, then. I think we should jump right into our interview and
is
talk
she
to
on?
Carrie.
All right.
I'm hoping this is Carrie. We'll see. So we're going to go live now with the caller on the line.
Caller, are you there?
All right. Let's see if we get you. All right. Welcome to Weed Day Wednesday. Carrie?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, now we can.
Good morning,
Woo-hoo,
Carrie.
Welcome.
Okay, great.
Thanks for being on our show. Good morning.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, we're reading a bit about your bio. Very interesting. Why don't you tell our listeners out there a little bit about yourself and a little bit about LEAP and how you two got involved and what's happening in this wacky world of marijuana out there?
Sure. I actually graduated from college with a degree in sociology and criminal justice, and I think that I had some kind of naive college girl dream that I was going to go out and make a difference in the world. And when I graduated from college, my first job out of college, I worked as a prison guard in an all-male high-security prison in Canyon City, Colorado. And, you know, as a 23-year-old woman, that was a very interesting job, and have seen a lot of things. I ended up going back through the police academy. I became a sheriff's deputy here in Colorado as well, still working in corrections. And the longer that I spent in it, the more that I realized that there was nothing that I was going to be able to do that would actually affect change. It felt like a very broken system, and I felt kind of like an overpaid, glorified babysitter of nonviolent offenders, so many of which were men and women who were in jail or prison on nonviolent drug offenses. So that being said, I got out of that world. I went back to business school. I've been an entrepreneur since 2003. Last year, I began working in the cannabis industry, and I hired a consultant. She's been in the industry for a long time, named Christy Lunsford, and I told her, I said, you know, I'd really like to get more involved in the advocacy piece of drug policy reform and cannabis reform. And she named off some really great organizations. She said, you know, there's the DPA and MPP and SSDP, and I didn't know what those terms meant at the time. But then she said, oh, wait a minute, there's LEAP. You need to talk to Jason Thomas, who is a speaker for LEAP as well. And as soon as I found out what LEAP was, I thought, oh, my God, this is the organization that I want to be a part of. This is the organization that can carry the message that I've been thinking about the whole time. And what LEAP is, it stands for Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, and it's a nonprofit international. It's a human rights organization, and it's made up of current and former criminal justice and law enforcement professionals, whether that be police officers or judges, prosecutors, prison superintendents, correctional officers, DEA agents, other people, other professionals who've kind of worked and seen firsthand the inside of what the war on drugs looks like, and now seek to end it. Now seek to end prohibition, because it's the prohibition of drugs that caused the issues, not the drugs themselves. It's the policy around it. So it's people coming together, carrying a common message to get that out, because we're chipping away at drug policy and at the drug war, but we really won't be able to end it until we get that critical mass of people in law enforcement, within our communities, get the message out to elected officials that the way that we've been dealing with drugs and people who use drugs in our society has not worked, will not work, and that we need to come about it from a different perspective.
Let me ask, when you said you first started, you were 23,
uh-huh.
and you had hopes and dreams of going in and changing the world there. What is it that you wanted to change? And when you got into the system, what did you find was so wrong that you felt that you couldn't even make a dent, that you wanted to leave it?
I think that for me personally, as an individual, I've never been a judgmental person. I've always been, you know, an empathetic person, someone who tries to meet somebody else where they're at, and was thinking that, you know, from the correction side, that there might actually be, you know, it's called corrections, and that feels like, just such a wrong word. It feels like it's really about retribution, and it's really about, it's punishment, that there really is no reform, and there really weren't tools for, you know, we kind of lock people up and we expect them to do something different when they get out, but we don't give them the tools that they need while they're in there. You know, we don't, the,
right.
the prison where I worked at here in Colorado is where we make Colorado license plates. So what kind of job skills do you get from that? What kind of job skills do you get from putting the little tag that says it expires in, you know, March of 2015 on your license plate into an envelope? So, you know, really got in there and realized that we're not providing enough education, enough tools, enough support on the outside for when people do get out for them to be contributing members of society. And then the screwed up thing about that is for so many people who have exited the criminal justice system that we've now labeled them and we've branded them and we make it so hard for them to find housing, to find good jobs that pay so that they can support their families. You know, we kind of strip them of all of these things and expect them to be better citizens with less than what they came in with. Like, we've taken that away from them and expect them to do something different. And it feels infuriating that, you know, the recidivism rate is so high for people who exit prison that, I don't know the exact number, it's in the 60 percentile of people who recidivate and are back into jail or prison within 3 years of their release. And it's because they don't have, like if we taught technology in prison, that there are a lot of really smart people behind bars, a lot of talented people whose talents have been kind of misplaced or displaced. But if we could kind of take that talent and kind of funnel it into something where, you know, if we taught technology in prisons that where people could do good with it, you could actually make a decent living with it, support families, contribute to society. But a lot of times, you know, we come up with prison programs where, you know, let's take a barber, for example. Okay, you learn to be a barber in prison, but when you get out of prison, you actually need to have a state license. Like, that's a regulated industry.
Right.
So, and as it comes to the marijuana industry and this new industry that we're creating, I just got back from the International Drug Policy Reform Conference, and a lot of the talk was about inclusion. And, you know, we as a society and through our drug laws, we've really kind of oppressed and, you know, our communities of color have really been the ones that have borne the burden of marijuana prohibition since its inception. And as we begin to end it, and as this is happening, there's kind of a growing concern that people within these communities, that the numbers are shocking when you look at, you know, the number of arrests and incarcerations by color, that it's disproportionately black and brown-skinned individuals who are being imprisoned when whites and blacks use and sell drugs at the same rate, but, you know, people of color are imprisoned at much higher rate and much harsher sentences. So how, as we build out this legal marijuana industry, do we include people that have borne the brunt of, you know, the persecution for drug crimes? And,
right.
you know, so there's a lot of talk of how do we build policy that does include people, and that part of the conference was fascinating.
Now, we know, you know, some people want to legalize or decriminalize all drugs, not just marijuana. We've heard that stance as well. What did you hear at the reform conference that you went to? What are people's stances versus, you know, just taking cannabis, you know, off scheduling or descheduling it or rescheduling it? Or what are your thoughts on that?
So LEAP actually kind of takes the position, and we are for the ending of prohibition and regulation of all drugs. And that doesn't mean legalization. Like, people hear that and they're like, what? You want to legalize heroin? And so I think that there's a misconception of what legalization means. And legalization means setting up a structure of regulation and control. So at the drug policy conference, you know, there are a lot of things. Switzerland, for example, has they have heroin clinics. So people go to a clinic and they're administered heroin by a doctor in a secure medical setting. They have no overdose deaths. They have no disease transmission. It's reduced crime significantly because people who are addicts aren't out there committing crimes so that they can get the drugs that they need to function. They're able to go about their lives. They can hold down jobs. And in the process, many of them are able to transition through kind of substance abuse programs to get better and to get off of it and to reintegrate into society. So at the conference,
I'm sorry, can I just ask? About on that topic, are those programs readily available for within those countries? So, is it something required by patients? So, if a patient is going to get heroin or whatever drug that they're addicted to in that moment, if they're going to get that from an actual doctor, is the doctor actually making them go through the program in order to get that to wean themselves off, or what? How does that work? I mean, how would you explain that to somebody? Because that's everyone's question is, oh, they're going to be doing heroin and acid and running the streets and doing this and being crazy. And what happens to the person after they go get their heroin dose from the doctor? Do they stay there in the office? Do they leave? What do they do?
I was going to say it's a really interesting. So this part of it is new to me. I lost my girlfriend to an overdose in 2004. And it was maybe 2 months ago was the International Overdose Awareness March. So here in Colorado, we've got a center called the Harm Reduction Action Center, and it's a place where we have a needle exchange program, because part of the issue is that with people sharing needles, users are going to use. And right. If they're reusing needles that somebody else has used, the incidences of HIV and hepatitis C, you know, it can be alarming at the rate at which those diseases can spread. So the Harm Reduction Action Center, you know, we have a syringe exchange program where people can bring in their dirty syringes and trade them out for new. So I think part of the misconception is that, you know, if we set up systems like this, or, you know, we don't have, they're called SIFs. They're safe injection facilities. We don't have them in the United States right now. Other countries do have them, and it's where people can come on site. Again, it's a clean place. There are stations where they, you know, it's people not sitting behind dumpsters and overdosing and dying, you know, because they're doing it in hiding. The people who are going to use are going to use, but we can protect them that drug users are not bad people. Drug users are drug users who have had an issue at some point in their life that have brought them to that point. And instead of stigmatizing them to the point where they're doing it in private, or they're doing it dangerously, or, you know, Colorado just passed a Good Samaritan Act where, you know, let's say you and I were using heroin together and you begin to overdose, where I would be like, oh, my God, I don't want to get arrested, and I leave you there to die.
Right.
Whereas
yeah.
In Colorado, we've passed laws that if I call for emergency assistance, I'm not going to get in trouble. So we're
right.
Saving lives that way. So it's really a lot of the conference was about harm reduction and how do we protect people. You know, I lost my girlfriend. She was an amazing friend. She was a mother. She was somebody's daughter. I loved her, and she had a drug problem, and she got clean, and the reason that she overdosed was because a lot of times overdose happens after somebody's been clean, and the body doesn't metabolize. You know, you take a deadly dose, something that you may have been able to take before, your body's not used to taking, and it shocks your system, and you die. So it's kind of really that advocacy piece of letting people know that there are alternatives. And as far as LEAP's position on legalization of all drugs, that it's not at all an easy fix. And there's not a one-size-fits-all answer. And, okay,
right.
Heroin clinics are working in Switzerland, but what would it look like if we, you know, legalized other drugs? And it's not, you know, first off, we've made drug use and the whole war on drugs, we've made that a law enforcement issue. And it's really not a law enforcement issue.
Nope.
It's a public health issue.
It is.
So
true.
It requires, you know, it'll require a lot of people to keep reforming this. So it'll take law enforcement, and it'll take health officials, and it'll take policymakers, and it'll take educators. So it'll take a community to come up with the solution. And that's what was really, really cool about the conference last week, was just kind of the spectrum of people from across the world that kind of come together. And, I mean, it's people from across all political perspectives with very different life experiences, but who kind of all share this passion for kind of changing people's fears and the ignorance and prejudices that surround and fuel the war on drugs. To come up with more effective ways of dealing with it in our lives and in our communities.
Well, I really thought what you called it, like restructuring the system. It's not a broken system. I don't want to use that word. I love the restructuring. It's something we've grown out of, and it's something that we need to look at and start changing that reform.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was in social work for 10 years, and I love where you were coming from, the point of, you know, those harm reductions are so... harm reduction conferences are so important to go to because you get this insight from other people that really just share the light on what would make sense, or what are we doing that's not working anymore, and let's try something new. You also said fueling the war on drugs. Can you talk a little bit about the privatized prison system and just kind of how that fuels the whole war on drugs?
Sure. It's actually really sad. The private prison industry is a $3.3 billion industry, and in effect, you know, it's a for-profit model, so it essentially works like the Motel 8. So if you don't have a body in the bed, you're not getting paid. So we've effectively kind of commoditized human beings and human lives for the sake of profit. And there are big lobbies out there that fight against drug reform, because if you have to have prisoners to run a prison, and there
right.
are communities, like when I worked in Canyon City, that it's a prison complex, so there are 13 prisons down there. So it's an entire town that relies on that system to bring income into the community. And so it's worked to me that, you know, we're looking at this in such a misguided way that we've built this. You know, our prisons are so full. We, you know, the United States has 5% of the world's population, so a very small percent of the entire world's population, but we have 25% of the world's prison population. So the
why
way
is that?
Why is that?
Yeah, is it all just for money? I mean, are they encouraging people to commit crimes so that they can keep these jobs in these small communities?
We don't encourage people to commit crime at all. We're arresting people at alarming rates, especially on, you know, nonviolent drug offenses. And, you know, oh God, there's so many things that I wanted to...
Let it out, Carrie. Let it out.
Go for it. So, you know, with things like our stop and frisk policies, that it's kind of like low-hanging fruit. So in big cities like Baltimore, Philadelphia, L.A., D.C., do you have any idea what percentage of the black male population aged 20 to 35 are in prison, on probation or parole? Would you take a guess?
I'd say 30, 40%.
50. 50% of the black male population in those communities who are aged 20 to 35 are currently under criminal justice control. And so it's kind of, that's the low-hanging fruit. And in policing, the model has kind of changed to a data-oriented policing model where now we're looking at arrests. So if you and I are, let's say the three of us are all police officers, and you make 50 drug arrests this month because you go and you can just pat down anybody that you want on the street, you find a joint on them, there's your arrest, you take them to jail, you can get over it. You know, I worked in booking for a long time, and there's a process. You know, you bring somebody in, you have to fingerprint them, you have to take their pictures, you have to inventory their property. It's a long process. So from a policing standpoint, you know, it's easier and safer to get those 50 arrests than maybe me, that maybe I'm doing real police work, what I consider real police work, and that's going out and that's fighting violent crime. That's finding the rapist, and that's finding the murderer, you know, or the people who are out there committing violent crime. But I might only make one or two arrests a year because it involves actual real police work, and I'm not discounting the work that police officers do because it's such a critical role. But again, if we move the focus away from kind of that low-hanging fruit, and that's how, you know, we've come to this place of mass incarceration. In the 80s, we've created mandatory minimums. So people who've committed fairly insignificant drug crimes can be in prison for the rest of their lives. And, you know, there's a part of that that makes me furious. California has filed a state of emergency because of such severe prison overcrowding. And, you know, prison overcrowding is dangerous to inmates. It's dangerous to officers. But in California, they spend $47,000 a year to house one inmate for 1 year. The cost to go to Harvard for 1 year is about $33,000 a year. I have two children in our public education system. So I've got two public school children. And at kind of the average across the United States of the money that we spend on public education is about $10,000 per public school student. So we're spending $10,000 a year to educate our future leaders, and we're spending $47,000 a year to house one inmate who, in all likelihood, once they get out, will recidivate and will be back in the system within 3 years. So as a taxpayer, again, it just feels like such a misappropriation of resources, of police priorities. Back in the 1960s, the murder clearance rate was in the 90th percentile, which means that we solved 90% of the murders that happened. And in today's day, where we've got such advanced capabilities, we've got, you know, DNA, we've got ballistics, we've got fingerprinting, we've got all these other resources, and we're only solving about 60% of murders. And that's, again, because resources are being diverted from true crime to fighting nonviolent drug crime. So much of it feels really frustrating.
Yeah. Well, and it goes back to your definition that we were reading about, you know, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. You're not going to get them, especially when you've got, you know, with the overcrowdings of any system, it's going to fail. It's not, you've got too many parts that are just being barely focused on instead of focusing on what really needs to be you know, addressed. And I'm sure the prison systems are just notorious for that. Do you, when you were in there, did you happen to know of the percentage of cannabis users, you know, say for petty offenses like having a pipe paraphernalia or having a joint or having an eighth or something small? Was there a lot of prisoners in there for that kind of stuff?
You know, for me personally, I don't remember that part of my work, but the statistics say that, you know, there are like 800,000 marijuana arrests made every year. So almost a million people a year are arrested and have something added to their permanent record that in all likelihood will follow them for most of their lives. And so that there's a part of it that I'm looking into right now as well and wanting to research and know more about, and it's called retroactive relief. And Oregon is moving forward with it. Colorado really hasn't done anything with it. But it's for what happens to the people who are currently serving time for crime that is no longer illegal.
Mm.
And other countries throughout the world kind of keep up with that. So, you know, if I was charged with a marijuana offense and that offense is no longer illegal, what are we doing for those people? Like,
right.
So I think that we're not doing much.
Mm.
So there are so many pieces that play into it and so much work that needs to be done. So again, going back to the Drug Policy Alliance conference last week, that it was a highly emotional conference for me just because you get a chance to see all of these people who are of the same mindset, who are fighting for the same thing, maybe from different places, certainly from different countries, but, you know, it's just a really diverse and growing movement that it was cool to be a part of. And Neil Franklin, who is the executive director of LEAP, was honored. He was given an award at the awards ceremony for his contribution to the movement. He's been the executive director of LEAP since 2010 and had a long history, like 33, 35 years, I'm not exactly sure the number of years that he spent in law enforcement, who watched one of his best friends die in a drug deal gone wrong, so has really firsthand experience of what that kind of loss looks like and kind of the futility of fighting that war. And so kind of under his guidance, the people that he's being able to pull together. So like you said, it's different when you hear a law enforcement official or a judge or a prosecutor or a DEA agent, people who have fought that war, the message sounds different coming from those people. So
it sure does.
You know, I'm feeling very fortunate to have found a place where I fit, where I can kind of bring that message to other people.
Yeah. Well, currently you're a PI and you have the 420 Intel Agency. Is that correct?
Yeah, actually, that company merged with another company, so the company now is called Catch Fire CX, and we provide mystery shopping services to dispensary owners. So it's another part of being able to help with kind of the regulation of the industry. So to make sure that, you know, if you go into a dispensary, it's kind of evaluating the overall experience. So everything from, is it clean? Were IDs being checked? You know, what was the information that the bartenders are relaying to consumers? And, you know, because I've had experiences where I've gone in to do a mystery shop and, you know, I act like I don't know anything. And I remember one time I bought an edible, like a 70 milligram edible and said, you know, I'm brand new to this. Can you tell me how I do this? And the bartender said, well, I'd probably just eat the whole thing, but you might want to just bite it in half. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, that's still 35 milligrams. And I was like,
oh, my God.
So, you know, that affects not just, you know, that would make it so that me as a consumer, if that was the experience that I had, I would never want to probably consume again. It affects the industry all the way down. So it affects that dispensary, it affects that brand, and then that person who had that bad experience tells somebody else about the bad experience that they had. So it's kind of just helping people within the industry understand messaging, branding, how their frontline personnel represents their companies, how do we kind of bring about better training and education. So I think, you know, it's kind of my small part to help again in creating those standards that don't necessarily exist yet.
When do you think our country will either, you know, standardize cannabis for everybody or somehow or regulate it? You know, it's hard to use any one term, legalize it, decriminalize
right.
it. When are they going to just do something with it so that our entire country can use it like we can alcohol or anything else?
Yeah, that was an interesting part of the conference. It's kind of that same thing of, you know, I think that we'll see, you know, definitely more states coming on in 2016, but I think a lot of it will have to do with the presidential election and who we have in charge. But I think that, you know, that will, you know, obviously either help our movement or could harm our movement. So I think that but there's a lot up in the air. I don't, you know, a lot of people are saying, you know, by 2020 we'll have this regulated structure, but I think that it's really hard to tell. I think we just keep moving forward to the way that we're moving forward. We learn lessons, you know, like how Ohio's issue 3, that ballot initiative, lost. Mm-hmm. So kind of looking at why did that lose and how do we do that better? What lessons did we learn so that we can the next go around do a better job of it so that, you know, people in Ohio can have that access to the medication that they need. So I think it's just being kind of hyper aware and vigilant in how we run these campaigns and the messaging that we're putting out. You know, people are saying, you know, buddy, that kind of icon that they use for their ballot initiative, that, you know, is that really how we want to represent it? And maybe the next time we do it, that's not who we use kind of as our mascot. And I don't know. It'll be really interesting to watch, especially in 2016, of what happens. And it's really interesting to watch, you know, kind of as the presidential debate continues to unfold, that the candidates are being forced to take a position on the issue. So it's interesting to listen to the language and how that's being positioned and how receptive that will be by the public.
Yeah, absolutely. Because they are saying slightly different things. I mean, you know, Hillary talks of moving it to Schedule 2. You know, Bernie talks of just legalizing it altogether.
Yeah, de-scheduling.
Right.
De-scheduling.
So they are. It's nice that they're forced to take a stance. You know, when Mr. President Obama took his stance when he was coming into office, he said, "Yeah, I smoked, I inhaled. That was the point." Like, duh. Kind of made people feel stupid for even asking about it. It was like, okay, next question. Let's move on to something important. Let's, you know, move on to something relevant. But this is relevant now. It's really relevant. It's taken this whole country by storm. There isn't someone in any state that isn't affected by this somehow. Everybody has a story. We used to whisper about what we did at our health center. Like, we were, you know, medical marijuana. And now you say it and everyone's like, oh yeah, well, my cousin's brother's niece is doing, you know, or my aunt or my grandma or...
Right. Or, hey, I just got my card.
Yeah, or hey, I just got my card, you know. It seems like everybody's affected by it somehow. Is there a message that you would say, you know, to the new person listening to this? Like, what is it that is so great about this plant that, you know, you're out there pushing the the barriers and the envelopes, you know, with what you...
I kind of think what I'd like to say is that, you know, we've had, you know, almost a century of, since Prohibition started, kind of up all drugs, and that was with the Harrison Act of 1914, but we've had so much propaganda that we've been fed, especially, you know, younger people through the DARE era. Like, that was just a little bit before my time, but of kind of the message that we've been taught and the things that we've been told. So I would just say, be smart about it, and you don't have to take anybody's word for it. You don't have to be a consumer of it at all to be an advocate for it. And I would say, read, research, ask questions. And when you're asking questions, it's okay to ask questions of both sides, because if you understand kind of the opposition's feelings about it, that gives you a chance to understand where that, because so much of that is fear-based. It's not based on truth. It's based on kind of fear and ignorance. So sometimes it's really just a matter of education. And, you know, over the course of this last year, since I've been involved in the space, I've learned so much, and I read and I read and I read and I ask questions. So I would say, you know, don't be afraid to ask questions, and it is more out in the open. A lot of people are still really uncomfortable talking about it, and that's okay, because it has been stigmatized for so long. And, you know, I have a 12-year-old and almost 10-year-old, and I have very, very open conversations with my children about the work that I'm doing and why it's so important. So I think it's even, you know, if we worry about children and drugs, again, it comes down to education. And, you know, I grew up in the time where it was just like, no, you don't do drugs, you don't do this, and
you don't talk
about it, and that's not a realistic expectation, because if we don't talk to our children about it, they're going to get the information from somewhere else, and the likelihood that that's correct information is probably not going to happen.
Right.
So I'd rather it come from me and have the open discussions and let them ask me questions about it than information that they're going to find out on the Internet or YouTube or from their friends. So ask questions and absorb as much as you can.
Can I ask what your kids think about it? You said they're 12 and 7, is that what you said?
12 and almost 10. And,
well, 12 and 10.
And I think that they understand how marijuana is a medication, and I try to share with them whenever I can, especially when stories come out about children who are using it, like from a CBD perspective, children who have suffered, you know, through a lifetime of seizures. And there are more and more cases where families are winning court cases that allow their children to have their medication while in school. So kind of the positive effect that this medicine has had on people's health and how it's changing people's lives. And that, you know, I myself, I'm a recovering alcoholic. I'm 16 years sober. So I'm saying that there are other alternatives for people. That I was very scared. I suffer from anxiety, so my doctor had prescribed Xanax, and that really scared me. Like, I know who I am and the challenges that I faced with alcohol. I didn't want to go that route. So it's looking at the alternatives that people have and the way that people are able to integrate that safely into their lives. And the way that they're able to do it safely is that we have to regulate it and have.
Uh-oh. Did we lose you? Wait a minute.
You still there?
Oh, there you are. Oh, we lost you for a second. Okay.
Oh, I think I hate to do this to you, but I have a call that I have to run to.
There we go. That's what that was. Okay. Thank you so much for being on, Carrie Roberts of Leap. What a pleasure and a joy, and we'd love to have you on again. Thank you, and good luck. Best of luck to you and your family, and keep up the good work. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for doing what you do, and thanks for having me on.
Oh, you bet. Thank you. Take care.
All right. Thank you.
All right.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Carrie Roberts, everybody, of Leap, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition.
That's awesome. Wow.
There you go. So, I love it. Catch Fire, CX. She's a private eye, people. She's sending people in to do quality checks and quality control into your dispensaries to write reports up. I love it. I love it.
Well, it's so important. You know, with this being such a new thing, you know, places are popping up. People sometimes don't know how to run a well-refined dispensary like this, and some things could, you know, fall to the wayside, like her incident that happened at the dispensary. Said, you know,
My Lord, even if she ate 35,
I mean, what grams. a horrible feeling. That
would have been horrifying for somebody. I would, you know.
Well, Carrie,
count
me in for that private eye investigation on the dispensaries. I'll do that with you.
Yeah, we'll be hitting up. If we would scare people walking in the front door, they'd know. They'd be like, oh, no, my God, they're here. Oh, God.
But I think it's so important because this is something, you know, I'm not an expert, but I do a lot of research, and I have had quite a background in cannabis. I think it would be pretty interesting to walk in and start, you know, really trying to help out that first-time patient that does come in, and
that's
keeping the industry clean to so where someone doesn't have one of those experiences where it's something that they'll never try again, and they think it's a waste of money, it was too much, or the experience that they had was horrendous.
Yeah.
And, you know, trying to keep that.
Go back.
Exactly. This is a new medicine here in the United States again, and regulating it and taxing it, I get all that, but what we also have to do is talk to people about how to use it again.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, so many people grew up smoking it. Well, there's so many different ways to use this medicine now, and it's so important to know how to use it in that realm. So if you are eating edibles, first of all, you've got to know how much it was made with. You know, in these, some of these places, the delivery places, I'm not sure how far they're keeping up with some of the regulations on how to talk to their patients about it. You know, because those places are definitely
drivers.
That's what I'm saying. So this worries me because these people, someone just gets their card, for instance.
Yep.
I don't know of any dispensaries, but I did get this flyer on my car, or I saw it somewhere. They call them up. It's the medicine's not made right, or it's tampered with. You've got someone who's got a deathly
MS
or something in their immune system that it's very low in mold, mildew, whatever
chemicals.
Pesticides. Too much, not made right, salmonella, all of these different things that can fall under this realm is just so important to clean up right now, because we would hate for this to start succeeding and, you know, how we've come this far. And then because of ignorance and greed, you've chosen to put medicine out on for people, which can harm people.
Yep.
So,
can't do it.
Thank you, Carrie, for doing what you do.
Yeah, thank you.
I think it's awesome.
Expose the bad eggs.
Exactly.
All right. Check this out. Alaska Marijuana Control Board voted 3-2 in favor of allowing the consumption of marijuana at dispensary retail stores. If approved by Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallett, Alaska would become the first state to permit regulated areas for marijuana consumption outside of private property, such as a person's home. Adults would be able to purchase marijuana at any dispensary retail store and consume it in a designated area on the property. Local laws banning indoor smoking will still apply. Other states that have legalized recreational marijuana use offer no state-sanctioned place to consume marijuana forcing people to stay at home. Well, we do have the 420 social clubs
down
right here in Tucson. No longer?
No.
Oh, boy. Well, we did have one.
We did, but no longer.
Didn't know about that one.
Yeah, that just, I heard about that the other day.
All right, then. Sorry, we had one.
I mean, not personal, but it was told to me that there are no longer.
They're no longer in operations?
Well, please do your research on that. Look
good,
it up.
Good for them for trying.
Yeah, always good for them for trying.
Yeah.
I think anyone that takes this and sees it as an opportunity to really help the community, provide a place where people can feel comfortable, because that's really what they were trying to do.
Yeah.
It was to provide a place that people really did feel
safe. And camaraderie. Like,
and camaraderie.
Talking to like-minded people.
For so long, this has been such a closeted...
Taboo.
Such a closeted using recreational time. So usually you're at a friend's house and you're all there, you know. This was bringing it a little bit more out in the open. This is, you know, downtown Tucson, right outside 4th Street, you know. And so it became this, well, you know, the...
Well, it was the 420 Social Club.
420 Social Club. So it's just different. And as this industry opens up more and we're going to start seeing different places, you know, cannabis cafes, you know, the resorts that are happening in South Dakota, you know, on the Native reservations. We're going to start seeing a lot more stuff where it's becoming to be more of a social
norm
to get together, like bar-like feeling.
Hang out
with your friends, be able to smoke in a group and have discussions, because what this drug does, this plant, this...
I don't like to call it a drug. What's the definition of a drug? I like plant.
Yeah.
What's the definition of a drug? Look that up, would you? We're going to look that up right now and find that out. Because it's, you know, it is very social for people.
It is.
And it's a it's great to get out and put your cell phones down. Mm-hmm. And actually sit around in a group and pass your pipe around, as John Denver says, and talk. And
you know what? There's different.
And it says a drug is a medicine or other substance which has physiological effects when ingested or otherwise introduced into the body.
Into the body.
Into the body.
Into the body.
So caffeine is a drug, for sure.
Yeah.
Say it.
Yeah. Caffeine.
Is water a drug?
No, because it doesn't change.
Is water a drug? That's our question for you. Is water a drug? That's your almighty question for you guests out there listening in. Is water a drug? It changes your physiological structure. Yep. We got a little nurse over there shaking her head going, well, she might be right on this one. She's usually full of, but she might have something here. She might have it. Is water a drug? Come on, folks. Call in. 646-915-8421.
We want to hear from you.
We haven't even told you about tumbleweeds. We haven't even played our commercial. You ready? Here it goes.
If you suffer from one of these medical conditions and have been diagnosed by an Arizona licensed physician, medical cannabis may help relieve your symptoms. Tumbleweeds Health Center is Arizona's premier cannabis certification, health, and education center. Our primary focus is to help the patients of Arizona obtain their medical marijuana card and educate everyone about medical cannabis. With current medical records, approval is a simple process. Contact Tumbleweeds Health Center to see if you qualify for your Arizona medical marijuana card.
All right. Get your medical marijuana card.
Bellstar.
Wow. Get your card. We just got a different definition of water. Let's
a
hear it.
A little double dose.
It's crazy. And where was this on? Is this Wikipedia? It's Google. And this is Syracuse, New York. Water is a street name for a cigarette or joint that has been dipped in embalming fluid that has been laced with PCP. Syracuse police say the drug has played a role in recent crimes in the city. Wow. So you take a cigarette or a joint, dip it in. Why embalming? Like, why not?
I think there's
natural,
a high. Well,
like
I mean,
honey or
you, what you're really
oh,
doing,
right,
what you're doing
you
is you're dipping
PCP,
it in there a little bit extra than what the
a
company,
joint,
cigarette company
embalming
did.
Chemicals too. That's pretty. It's probably damn. That's crazy. That'll blow your head off. You've seen those commercials where your head just goes boom, in a giant cloud of purple smoke. Oh my gosh. Yes, I think we're in a giant cloud of purple smoke. Guess what, guys? Speaking of giant clouds of purple smoke, it's that time. We didn't even get to our weed fact of the day. Oh, my God. Weed tip, if you want to make the most efficient use of your marijuana, you should avoid handling it directly with your hands whenever possible.
That, you know what the cannabis kid says.
Bam.
You should never touch your medicine.
Don't touch your weed.
You're not smoking your fingers, folks.
Don't do it. All right. Thank you, Carrie Roberts, for joining us.
That was awesome. We would definitely want to have her back on.
You know it.
We love hearing those.
Yeah, I have so many more questions.
It's really important to hear what's going on in the law enforcement world, because this is such a law enforcement thing, which she said it shouldn't be. It's a public health issue, so remember that.
All right. Also, coming up, we've got the Castle Company coming back on. That'll be fun. I think that's next week, I believe. And some more new and exciting guests that we met at the Cannabis Conference a couple weeks ago. But most importantly, remember...
Be smart.
Be safe.
And educate.
And happy Thanksgiving, everybody.
Woo-hoo.
We're thankful for you.
Woo-hoo.